This is Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices. I'm your host, Amber Khan. Earlier in this episode, we met the filmmaking team behind a new documentary introducing Western audiences to the life and legacy of Guru Nanak Dev Ji, the first guru and founder of Sikhism. Jerry and Adam Krell describe Guru Nanak's vision of a world where all people are equal and living in harmony, a utopic vision echoing the core teachings of Buddha, Jesus, Muhammad, and other religious visionaries. Yet the distance between peaceful coexistence and violent conflict appears to be growing around the world, including in India, the birthplace of Sikhism. But first, a little history. During the time of Guru Nanak's birth in 1569, the subcontinent was part of the Mughal Empire, which began in 1526 under the Central Asian ruler, Babur, the descendant of Genghis Khan. Before his revelation, Guru Nanak moved to Sultanpur to work as an accountant for the Muslim government. It was a reflection of the times under the ruler Akbar, who many describe as the strongest and most effective of the Mughal rulers, in part because he was able to consolidate the empire. But it was not bloodless. There were many battles, but Akbar adopted a conciliatory policy toward Hindus and other minorities, enlisting them in his armies and government functions like accounting. This integration and recognition of the cultural, religious, political, administrative, and military structures that govern the empire were the chief factor behind its continued survival for another century and a half. But that would not remain. For nearly 200 years, the Mughals controlled the vast and diverse region that stretched from the west, present-day Afghanistan, to the far east of what is now Bangladesh. That is, until colonial Europeans arrived. After a series of battles led to the collapse of local rule and the rise of the colonial British Raj. In 1947, when British colonizers left India, the country went through what is known as partition. India's northeast region became the new nation of Pakistan. What happened next is described by the United Nations as the largest voluntary human migration in recorded history. An estimated 14 million people were displaced as Muslims in India fled to Pakistan and Hindus in Pakistan fled to India. And nearly 2 million died in communal violence. Fast forward to February 2020. In the wake of President Donald Trump's visit with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, mobs in New Delhi left at least 40 dead. Social media carried images of mosques, homes, and shops of Muslims being attacked, and videos online of unarmed men, women, and children being beaten in the streets as police stood by. Meanwhile, the region of Kashmir, India's only Muslim-majority territory, remains on lockdown, cut off from the internet and the outside world. To understand the nature of this violence, I spoke with Aisha Jalal, a professor of history at Tufts University in Boston, where she is also the director of the Center for South Asian and Indian Ocean Studies. Professor Jalal wants people to tease out the motivation of the violence. Is it really religiously motivated, or is it wrapped up in politics, nationalism, and extremism?
I think the biggest misconception is that everything that happens in South Asia has its origins in religion, and that there is this ubiquitous religious factor that explains everything in South Asia. And I think that's the greatest fallacy in trying to comprehend what is going on in South Asia.
The biggest fallacy they have is that to understand this region is to understand religious conflict?
That's right. Well, I mean, that religion is all-pervasive in the lives of people, and therefore South Asia is unique in that sense. I mean, even as people look at South Asia as a center for spiritual thought and practice, they are aware of modern conflicts that have enveloped it, which have had their roots in some degree of quote-unquote religion.
And where do you think that misconception comes from?
It's a colonial conception. The very idea of religion was transformed by the British in India. Religion is, by all accounts, a matter of personal faith in a creator, whatever that conception may be. To turn it, as the British did in the late 19th century, into a demarcator of identity, of difference, to demarcate people. So I think the problem has been that religion, from being a matter of faith, has become a matter of social identity, to differentiate you from others. Once the British decided to carry out census enumeration on the basis of religion, it became impossible for religion not to be relevant in public matters. I mean, it became a means for material advancement, not spiritual advancement.
What was it like before?
Well, prior to the British, there were Muslim empires, the Mughal being a case in point, in which Hindus, it was neither a Muslim empire nor a Hindu. It was an Indian empire in which Hindus and Muslims worked together. But when it came to politics, it was not unusual for Hindus and Muslims to come together. So faith was there, but faith did not automatically lead to a particular kind of politics, as is assumed today.
I asked Professor Jalal how she would rewrite the headlines coming out of India today. And in her answer, she refers to two political parties American audiences may not be familiar with. One is the BJP, or Bharatiya Janata Party. It's the right-wing political party, currently India's largest, and it's associated with the rise of Hindu nationalism, the party of Prime Minister Modi. The second is Aam Aadmi. It's a relatively new political party organized in 2012, with anti-corruption as its central focus. On February 8th, the Aam Aadmi Party won 62 of the 70 seats in the local state government, thus diminishing BJP's influence in the region. It should be noted that Aam Aadmi's coalition is multi-faith, and its spokespeople and leaders include Muslims, Sikhs, and Hindus.
I think it's an outcome of the recent electoral politics there. I mean, the victory of the Aam Aadmi Party and the BJP sort of expressing its displeasure at being kept out of power yet again. And its goons have taken to the streets and targeted Muslims. It's not for the first time that Muslim businesses have been attacked, Muslims have been killed. Some Hindus have also been attacked and killed. They might try to give the cover of religion, because clearly the victims are clearly religious. The point is, the entire Hindu community is not targeting these Muslims. So, I mean, I think it's important to realize that whilst victims are Muslims, targeted Muslims, this is not about Hindus falling on Muslims and Muslims falling on Hindus, but this is a BJP strategy for its own political purposes. I wouldn't sort of dignify it with the term religious. These are mundane, everyday political battles that they are fighting in the name of spiritual terms. But I think it's up to people to question whether this is indeed what their religion teaches them.
Is there an analogy that you see in the United States?
And I mean, America has always had a long-standing problem with race. So I think what race does, religion does for South Asia. So of course there are parallels. I mean, when you have racial tensions and eruptions, when you have controversies surrounding Black Lives Matter, then those are reminiscent of what kinds of debates are occurring in South Asia too. They are political debates.
And political debates meaning power.
Yes, I mean, I call them battles for social space. I mean, these are efforts to dominate social space. And so there are people who are going around saying, how dare the Muslims try to tell us what to do by protesting the Citizenship Amendment Act. So there are those who feel that they have no business expressing their opinion. And I do think that there are similarities in that sense.
Can you describe the Citizenship Act that you just referenced? Can you talk about that for a moment and explain it to those who may not be following that story right now?
The Citizenship Amendment Act was passed by the Parliament in India at the behest of the current government, the BJP government. It basically facilitates and expedites the acquisition of citizenship by refugees who have taken refuge in India from other countries. Certainly Afghanistan, Pakistan, certain countries have been named, Bangladesh, but not Myanmar, not Sri Lanka. People who are being repressed in these countries can seek Indian citizenship on an expedited basis, except Muslims. So that is the reason why Muslims see it in India as a first step to their marginalization, their disempowerment, and potentially elimination.
The Constitution of India, does it designate the country to be a Hindu country, or is there a religious majority or religious preference that is baked into the way the country has been founded?
The Citizenship Amendment Act is completely unconstitutional from the point of view of the establishment principles of the Indian Constitution. India is defined as a secular state. And in that context, choosing to exclude Muslims amongst those who are going to get expedited citizenship is to discriminate against Muslims, one category. And I mean, the principle of secularism, it's worth telling your audiences, is not, in India, is not a product of the separation of church and state. There was no church in either Islam or in Hinduism to separate from. So the principle of secularism in India is based on neutrality of the government towards all religious communities. The moment you begin to favor one over the other, you undermine the principle of secularism in India on which the Indian constitution stands.
And in the United States, secularism is often associated as eradicating religion from the public space. From your context, can you speak to what when you hear that, what comes to mind?
Well, I mean, religion cannot be eradicated from space in a context where the category religion has been given as much importance as is the case in South Asia. So as I explained to you, religion is part of census enumeration. You're enumerated as a Muslim or a Hindu. And this has been happening since the late 19th or mid-19th century onwards. I mean, you can't really tell anything about the person's individual faith. It's just a category.
Much like the construct of race.
That's what I mean. They're exactly very similar.
It's fascinating because I think right now, as you have more access to some of that history, and in part the democratizing effect of the internet and the ability to go back into the archives and question some dominant narratives, has more folks re-examining. But at the same time, those same resources, the internet and social media platforms, is used to amplify the narratives that you're speaking as ill-informed.
Not just ill-informed, but unquestioned. When you are reading or listening to the media without questioning, that's when the problems begin. And I think that what we need is to be a little bit more skeptical of what we are hearing, not least because there are multiple versions of the same event. And I think that's what we have to learn to live with. It's a complex world, and the temptation for easy answers is likely to lead you to fallacies.
I want to shift for a second to the role that the other religious traditions in India play. Right now, so many of the news stories coming out of Delhi and of India are about tensions that have flared between perceived enemies, Muslims and Hindus. It's one way to tell the story. But India is a multi-faith country. There are lots of different religious communities, not as in the same size as the Muslim and Hindu communities per se. You have the Sikh community, you have Christians, you have Catholics, you have Buddhists, you have different schools of Buddhism that are practicing in India. Can you speak to the multi-faith features of India and how those communities are playing a role right now?
I mean, they're all playing their role in their own lives. It's a question of who is targeted for political purposes because some electoral advantage is seen. You can tomorrow decide that you want to target the tribals of India, which is unlikely because they're useful to mobilize politically. At this moment, the two communities that have been targeted by the right wing, Hindu right wing, which is very pleased with its success in setting India on the road to becoming a Hindu Rashtra, is that they're targeting Muslims in the first place, and they're targeting secondarily Christian communities as well in some parts of India.
What is the history there?
I would say that these are battles for social space, targeting a community and clearing that space in order to take advantage. I think that's what it is. We want to dignify it with the name religiously motivated. That's your choice. I can't fight that. But there is very little evidence to prove that these are religiously motivated other than the elimination of an identity or a group identity that happens to be the other.
And how is the Christian community responding?
They're fighting. I mean, they're a much smaller community.
Are there a lot of Christians currently in the Punjab region, in the northern part of the country?
Not a lot. They are small minorities, whereas Muslims are pretty substantial minorities, even though in recent years their political representation has fallen appreciably. There are Muslims in West Bengal, there are Muslims in Assam, and of course, the largest Muslim concentration was in Kashmir.
Can I ask you to explain what's happening in Kashmir?
Kashmir is under Indian lockdown, has been for years, but since August of last year, when India unilaterally ended the status of Jammu and Kashmir as a state within the Indian Union, split it into two, and basically has turned Kashmir into a union territory, which means that it will be governed directly from New Delhi. All of this was achieved without any consultation or approval on the part of Kashmir's elected leaders. And this in India, the great democracy that we talk about. It's the most heavily militarized zone in the world. It's acknowledged as that. And 12 million Kashmiris are under the jackboot of over 700,000 paramilitary forces. So things are very difficult. There is a sense of desperation, I think, in Kashmir, which is likely to explode, and one doesn't know what form it will take, but it cannot be very good and positive. I mean, the psychological damage that's been done for decades of militarization, this degree of repression. I mean, it's Kashmir. I mean, as everybody says, I mean, it's like a powder keg waiting to just explode.
Why is this something that the U.S. should be concerned about? Western audiences should be concerned about?
I mean, Kashmir is located in a very strategically delicate area because it basically occupies that territory where the water, I mean, all the rivers that Pakistan and India depend upon in the north comes from Kashmir. And Pakistan is the lower riparian. So it's very concerned about who controls Kashmir. India has been building dams, and that's putting added pressure on Pakistan, the affairs of water wars. So even if nobody anticipates India and Pakistan going to war tomorrow, there is a very deep fear that this could accidentally lead to wars between two nuclear neighbors, which would be catastrophic, not just for South Asia and Kashmir, but for the world. But things could go very seriously wrong if we just take our eyes off it.
And how do you see the Trump administration's positioning? President Trump just went to India, while Delhi, as many headlines declare, Delhi is burning and Trump is meeting with Prime Minister Modi.
Well, I think Mr. Trump is known to only see the world from his perspective, and I don't think he understands what's going on as far as Kashmir is concerned. We know that he's made many offers to mediate between India and Pakistan, knowing fully well that India will not allow any mediation on Kashmir. He has also just recently returned from India, praising India's policies of religious accommodation or tolerance, if you like, whilst Delhi was burning and Muslims were being targeted. So I'm not sure that I can take him seriously on India at all.
I want to turn for a second to the Sikh community. There have been a lot of headlines about Gurdwaras providing safe refuge for Sikh, Hindu, and Muslim neighbors who were rallying together to prevent the Gundas and others from coming in. Could you speak to the relationship between the Sikh, Muslim, and Hindu communities as you're seeing the events unfold today?
So Punjab and Kashmir have had a long-standing relationship. This is not to deny that at the time of partition, Sikhs were targeted in the valley and elsewhere, and things did go wrong. But I do feel that there is, because of this long-standing regional relationship, a stronger empathy for what is going on in Kashmir on the part of Sikhs, who themselves have suffered a great deal vis-a-vis New Delhi's policies on federal principles. So I do think that that sympathy is there and it's genuine. And so it is important to realize that not everybody interprets events in Kashmir through the paradigm of religion. There is a human dimension. I think there are Indians who happen to be Hindu or Sikh who recognize that what is happening in Kashmir today is tomorrow likely to happen to them.
Can you speak to the policies that Sikhs may recognize or see as analogous or echoing memories of their own experience?
I mean, there are similarities in the kind of handling of these people being treated as anti-state elements or waging war on the state rather than just treating them as political dissidents. So I think that there's been a problem with the treatment of dissidents in these two border areas compared to elsewhere, because these are areas that border Pakistan, India's eternal enemy.
Eternal enemy. Do you see a future where there won't be eternal enemies?
Well, I don't see any future so long as they continue to see each other from their current positions. I mean, I think that there's a need to alter that relationship, which hasn't changed. And I think the animosities of partition before and after have made it very difficult. And the ongoing sort of tensions over Kashmir particularly have made it very difficult for India and Pakistan to really strike a kind of an even keel and restore relations that are normal between neighbors and not this degree of tension, which could at any time lead to unexpected catastrophe.
Unexpected catastrophe. That's a long way from Guru Nanak's vision of equality and unity for all. I asked Professor Jalal her thoughts about the Sikh American campaign to raise awareness about their faith and founder.
Obviously, the Sikhs feel that their distinctive identity, as they have tried to assert it, has not been acknowledged, particularly by the Hindus, who simply regard the Sikhs as another sect. So that conflict continues. I think that there is a problem with identitarian politics that I think has gone amok. And there's a need to restore perspective and realize that this is not just about identitarian politics, but issues of social justice that go across the board and not specific to any particular religious community. So I think that that facet has been at the heart of our current predicament, that we are continuing to see what are in fact everyday understandable political battles. We are seeing them through the lens of some glorified religious project, which I don't think it is necessarily.
That was Aisha Jalal, the Mary Richardson Professor of History at Tufts University. Her area of expertise includes history, diplomacy, and international politics. Jalal is the author of several books on the region, including Democracy and Authoritarianism in South Asia, A Comparative and Historical Perspective. That's all for this week. Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices, relies on the generosity of our supporters. And if you enjoyed this episode, I want to ask you to take a second and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast. Visit our website at www.interfaithradio.org to learn more about us. Find our archive of past episodes and sign up for our newsletter. This week's episode was produced by Kevin McCarthy and Kimberly Winston. We are taped at the WAMU studios in Washington, D.C., and we are grateful to our founder, Maureen Fiedler, and MC Yogi for our theme music. I hope you'll join us next week. I'm your host, Amber Khan.